for a long time.
Composition notebooks full of stuff.
You can let me finish?
No.
Welcome to episode number 53 of the Music Video Land podcast, put on by your very good friends at FilmDidn'tStart.com, which is coincidentally the music video database on the interwebs. Perhaps you've heard of these interwebs. If you ask your local Best Buy geek, I'm sure he'll point you to the right equipment to get yourself on there. My name is Adam Fairholm, and with me, as per usual, is Mr. Doug Klinger from Boynton Beach, Florida. How are you, Doug?
I'm super good, Adam, mainly because you dropped a Geek Squad reference right out of the gate in this episode, which I'm really happy about.
Have you ever worked for the Geek Squad?
No, but, you know, shout-outs are great.
It's important. Maybe they'll give us a discount on something.
Who knows? Geek Squatters are notorious listeners to this podcast, for sure. What we got going on?
Well, this week we have... I'm excited about this interview because... I'll tell you why. The music video industry works in mysterious ways. I think we all know that. And, you know, as we've done this podcast, we've learned a little bit about how the industry works.
And a whole bunch. We've learned a lot.
We have learned a lot. And you may have heard this term video commissioner being thrown a lot around. It's one of the credits that we accept on the site for music videos, and a lot of music videos have them. So we thought, let's talk to a real live, in-person, in-the-flesh music video commissioner. And we have a really fantastic music video commissioner on the podcast, Mr. Saul Levitz. He is a music video commissioner / producer at Columbia Records. And he is actually in the Houdini by Foster the People, directed by Daniels video. And it's a really interesting story about how he ended up in there. But he's got a lot of credits to his name. On a previous podcast, we had Mr. A.G. Rojas, who directed the 16 Saltines video for Jack White. And that was also commissioned by Saul, along with some great other videos like Passion Pits, Take a Walk, Band of Horses, Knock Knock, and a Raphael Sadiq radio. So it's a really interesting podcast, interesting interview, an interesting look at how music videos work on that level, where a video commissioner is coming in and acting as... you'll hear what Saul does. I'll let him explain it because he is the video commissioner. I am just a host of this podcast, Music Video Land.
That is your role during this hour.
That's right. I shouldn't try to explain things that the guests are explaining and that we've brought them on to explain. That's bad form. But his interview is coming up in the second half of this podcast.
Right. I guess that is a little strange technique that you've deployed tonight. Describing the things that will be better described later, but whatevs, we push forward, we sail along, because Music Video Land in this episode is over water.
It's a bridge over troubled water.
I don't know why, but it can be. I'm on board with that.
The nice thing about a bridge over troubled water is you don't have to care,
right? Because you're on the bridge. The bridge isn't troubled. I think that a cool thing to talk about In this episode, I don't know if you saw today, Green Day dropped a new video. It premiered today. And 2 days ago, Taylor Swift premiered a video. And as far as I could tell, I thought premiered meant uploaded to the internet. But apparently it means something more than that. Do you think it means something more than that, Adam?
Well, I think that's an interesting and far-reaching topic for a podcast, Doug. I'm glad you brought that up, because premiere is a very fluid term in the music video industry, and I think it's a good topic to talk about for this podcast. Because, like you mentioned, Doug, earlier this week, two music videos premiered, and one of them was a big one, Taylor Swift, very big country star. And music video premiered on CMT, on broadcast on cable TV, CMT, Country Music Television, MTV, and Teen Nick. on August 30th, and they, you know, they even have the time listed at 7:49 Eastern time, and then it later was on, you know, those respective website or a few websites like MTV.com, CMT.com, and VH1.com.
Yeah, it's funny they do the time thing, because the Green Day video that premiered today, or today when we're recording the podcast, which is Tuesday the 4th.
September 4th.
Tuesday, September 4th. They had a teaser video that they put out, which often accompanies a music video premiere. They'll put a teaser video out. Sometimes, in the case of Lana Del Rey, it's a full-length video that's just something else. Or in the case of Green Day, it was just kind of just like a preview of the video. But anyway, they have 2 p.m. Eastern was the premiere, which I think the time of the premiere meant more when they put them on TV, because, you know, the time of a music video premiere mattered when it was on TV, because that was your only guaranteed shot of seeing it. Otherwise, you kind of had to sit around and wait. And, you know, likely if it was a video that was worthy of a premiere, it was probably going to play again in the next hour. But if you weren't there at 8 o'clock to watch it, you might miss it, or might not get to see it again for a while and miss the conversation at the water cooler. But on the internet, just because the video premieres at 7, if you show up at 7:03, you could just hit play and watch it from the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting that they make, because in a lot of the press releases and things, they did make a big deal about the time. And I think that that kind of gives it an air of importance. Like, oh, 7:49 p.m. Eastern Standard Time is the first time you'll ever be able to see this Taylor Swift video. Because I think that, you know, obviously in the age of the internet, you can just throw something up and there's no, like, oh, by the way, this went on YouTube at such and such a time on such and such a date. And it harkens back to, I think, an era that you, I'm sure you remember it as well, Doug, because we were alive for this. But the era of the big music video TV premieres, do you remember these?
Of course I do. What the most famous one I can remember was Michael Jackson. He did a ton of them, and so there's not a most famous one that I can remember, but a most famous several, actually.
Well, let me see if I can spark your memory. They did premiered Black or White.
On Fox or NBC or some channel that wasn't MTV, I remember. It was like a broadcast network.
Well, it was November 14th, 1991. I was in Canada at the time, and I saw it. So I was one of those 27 countries that it premiered simultaneously, and that's a big premiere. And according to my sources, an estimated audience of 500 million people, which is definitely the largest ever for a music video. That is the Black or White, and probably George Wendt's largest production to date, also known as Norm on Chairs. He was in that video, as well as Macaulay Culkin.
Was it a broadcast network?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, in Canada, we had CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and a few other ones. We didn't have, like, NBC or anything like that, but it was definitely a broadcast thing. I don't even think we had cable in 1991. But it was definitely a broadcast network.
Yeah, that's fancy. That mattered a lot more. Even when it was an MTV premiere, it sometimes mattered a lot more. I think when it was on TV, because like I said before, that was your guaranteed chance to see it. There's no, you know, that's one thing, you know, people remembered about MTV and you know, before the internet in general, is waiting around for music videos. So the concept of knowing exactly when it was going to be played was kind of unique. Like, what do you think the purpose is, just so they have something to accompany the press release? What do you think the purpose is of having these premieres now in the internet age?
I think it's definitely something to put on a press release, because now there's a few ways to do it, right? There's a few there. You don't just have to have broadcast TV. Obviously, the Michael Jacksons of the world in 1991 could make a huge deal out of their music video. The Taylor Swifts of the world can make a huge deal out of their music video in 2012 and get it on TV at an exact time. Obviously, they're not doing 27 countries, and, you know, they're not getting an audience of 500 million people, but that's also the musical era that we live in. Taylor Swift is a crossover artist, but she's obviously not near anywhere the numbers that Michael Jackson was pulling in at his prime. But now we have a much more diversified premiere outlet system. One of those is blogs. So you can premiere on Pitchfork. You can premiere on something like Perez Hilton. Perez Hilton, does a lot of music posts, obviously promoted, but he will also premiere music videos. There's been a few instances of that. You can premiere on channels that do not ostensibly have anything to do with music videos. Some music videos have e-network premieres. Some do e-online. Some do
World Star Hip Hop is a famous one, mm-hmm. which a lot of rappers use. But although World Star Hip Hop is more popularized now for like showing crazy videos of like police brutality and weird like found footage. My music video premiered somewhere fancy.
Where did you just premiere, Doug? Could you please explain to us what music video is that and where?
I did a music video for Sam Friend, as you did. And my music video premiered on Cluster One, so I'm famous is what that means.
That's right. There are so many different venues to be able to premiere your video. MTV has their own MTV.com/music/videos/premieres, where they list all these different premieres. And the idea is that they have the embed before YouTube has it, because obviously if there's a YouTube embed or some, obviously Vivo also does premieres, but if there is some sort of proprietary embed that MTV has, which they do, they can have the music video, you know, right there for, you know, 6 hours, be doing takedown notices to YouTube for any people, and then, you know, that are, you know, just screen capturing and then uploading it to YouTube themselves. And then, you know, maybe 12 hours later, the official embed comes out, and then all the blogs get to link to it. But there are ways, you know, to, you know, have a site like MTV Premieres and, you know, use technology to their advantage to kind of keep the premiere, to keep traffic running to that site.
Sometimes there are outlets to premiere your video that help you kind of hammer your image. It doesn't just kind of benefit to help it get out there more. You know what I mean? To premiere on MTV.com, that's kind of a big deal now. Artists can tout that. But, you know, for the case of, like, if you have a music video that you want to make sure people know it's a comedy music video, or want to make sure you capture a comedy music video audience, then you might want to consider, if you have an option to do so, premiering that video on a site like Funny or Die, which will often premiere music videos, to make sure you capture that comedic audience, and again, also make sure that you hammer down that point that you're making a comedic music video.
That's very true. It's almost, in a way, like advertising. You know, a certain video will premiere on Perez Hilton, a certain video will premiere on E! Online. It is, you know, 15 years ago, if you wanted to premiere a music video and you wanted to reach a certain audience, then you had very limited opportunities to do so. So there are a lot of different channels to get your message out. And, you know, the nice thing is, if you are an artist that nobody has ever heard of before, and you, or a director that nobody's ever heard of before, and you want to get a music video out there, you can always just throw it up on YouTube, go on Twitter, and then call it a premiere.
Yeah, right, exactly. You could just let people know, my video premiered, and that just means you uploaded it. Or that means you released it. You could have uploaded it a while ago and had it hidden. What's that published thing? Teach us about YouTube, Adam. What does published and uploaded mean?
Well, there's a difference between a published video and an uploaded video. You can upload something on, you know, August 10th and then publish it on August 20th. And there are some differences in API data and things like that, and data that you get to figure out when that video is actually made available to the public. But you can do your own thing like that. You can go and, you know, Vimeo, you can do this as well. You can keep your video private and then let it out into the world when you feel like it's ready to do so.
Yeah, and it's important to note that because of that, though, that the YouTube upload date is not always the premiere date, and oftentimes it's not, because like you mentioned before, you know, sometimes it'll be a couple of weeks before YouTube gets the upload, and they always eventually do, and there's always eventually an official upload on YouTube. It doesn't live on CMT.com or PerezHilton.com forever. That doesn't seem – they're missing out on some natural audience that comes from YouTube. What do you think of these teaser videos, these, you know, to music videos? What main purpose do you think they serve?
I'm not sure about the teaser videos. Do you want to talk about lyric videos?
Well, I have a feeling teaser videos and lyric videos are probably doing a lot of times they could be serving the same purpose, especially if a lyric video precedes a music video, because those are just kind of free views. You know, the Green Day teaser video for the music video that they premiered today got 250,000 views last week. So that's from a label perspective, from an artist perspective, from a, you know, monetization perspective, that's obviously a positive.
Yeah, I feel like we should save lyrics videos for another and teaser videos for another podcast. And my reason for this, that is this, and we can preview another podcast conversation here, is because the lyric video for Taylor Swift's video that she just premiered, which I should say the name of, so everybody knows it. It's kind of a complicated name. We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. It's cold. The lyric video for that is not just a simple put your lyrics up on the screen. It is stop motion. It is actually a really well put together video. It could stand on its own full as a music video for a lot of artists, and not just, you know, smaller artists, but you know, mid-range to substantial artists. It could definitely stand on its own, and it has 10 million views on YouTube. So I think that's definitely an interesting conversation for another podcast.
Because, yeah, even the straightforward lyric videos sometimes are pretty interesting to look at. Some aren't just completely phoned in. There's a lot you can do with text and movement and stuff. So, yeah, that can be a conversation on its own. We'll tackle that another time. That's because right now we got bigger fish to fuck. We got bigger fish. We've got bigger fish to fry, and that fish's name is Saul, because we have an interview with a fish.
That's right, Mr. Saul Levitz, and I mentioned at the top of the podcast, we've been wanting to talk to a video commissioner for a long time, and we were really lucky to get Saul to sit down to talk to us about what he does. He's a video commissioner at Columbia Records, and he's also a producer there, which is extremely interesting, and I think is a little bit of an underreported and overlooked, at least in the public's view, aspect of the music video industry, because what he's doing and... you know, the impact he has on the videos that get to the public and get to us is really huge. So take a listen, at our interview with video commissioner for and producer for Columbia Records, Mr. Saul Levitz.
Yeah, my name is Saul Levitz. I'm one of the music video commissioners over here at Columbia Records, which is part of Sony Music Entertainment. And
we were just talking about the fact that the job of a music video commissioner is shrouded in mystery a little bit. A lot of people don't even know that position exists. So I was wondering if you could give an overview of, in the production process of a music video, where you fit in as a music video commissioner.
Yeah, I think, in the end of the day, I work for the label, and I'm always looking out for the best interests of our artists and the label. But truly, my role is kind of in between what the artist is looking for, what the label's looking for, and conversely, what production is looking for. So, and then you can also throw management in there as well, because sometimes those don't line up with the artists as well. So I'm really kind of, let's say, the middleman between all these different pieces that if I were not here, it would just be utter chaos with the amount of people and communication going back and forth. So I kind of serve to represent, I think, all those parties. And I think the best commissioners do that as well, because, you know, again, in the end of the day, I work for the label. And I'm in the business of furthering the careers of our artists, but sometimes that is not that clear, let's say, through the process, or the best route there is always not what everybody thinks. So, I don't know. Was that a good explanation or what?
That was, yeah.
Okay. It's pretty solid. And now are there... specific artists that you're given to work with, that and are there kind of reasons behind that, or is it more like whatever comes up and whoever's not busy?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. There's three of us here at the label, and we all, I think, tend to have our strengths and also work together in a great way where, you know, we fill in for each other from time to time. But I think, I mean, you know, obviously I'm, you know, a fan of a certain type of music, and you can't always, just like a director can't always make videos for the songs and the artists that they like, you know, I can't always commission videos for the artists that I'm always drawn to personally. So you kind of got to go outside of that. But I think there's definitely a part of it where you're drawn to those things. And let's say you raise your hand for those bands you care to work with. And I think between the three of us, it tends to split out quite nicely. And we haven't had to have any like mud wrestling or, you know, arm wrestling or any kind of fights over artists yet. So
that's the number one conflict resolution, mud wrestling. Just go to that first.
That's definitely the first one. Way down is like, you know, getting a therapist involved or some kind of like conflict management, you know, person or something like that. We try and go physical to get through any of our disputes.
And, you know, in terms of the sort of step-by-step process, when an artist wants to make a video for a track or even just any track off of a new album, are you the first person that gets that information and then, you know, starts the ball rolling from there?
Usually it's a decision that starts a bit earlier before it gets to us in video. You know, we kind of have this antiquated notion of the single, and that one song is really going to define an album and it's going to be popular out there in, let's say, the radio format or online or whatnot. And those decisions are made a little bit prior to where we get. And also that's kind of tied into how much money we have to spend on that particular song or whatnot. It's rare. It does happen. We're a part of that conversation. But usually that's been kind of deliberated upon by people who are better at making those decisions. I tend to always kind of like songs that are never singles from a lot of our artists. So I wouldn't trust myself to know what other people think in that manner. Other people are paid the money to make that decision. So,
and when that decision is made, is it a matter of you know, kind of figuring out what directing talent is going to work for this song?
Definitely. It's kind of turned over to us, whereas, you know, we try and fit people with fit our songs, fit our artists with the right person for the job, and that could be based on, you know, the song itself. It could be based on the budget. There's a lot of factors that go into that, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of handed over to us at that point. And luckily at Columbia, I'm not sure how it is at many other labels, but we have a good amount of autonomy to work with our artists to select directors that they're into or work that we see. We spend a lot of time like digging online, you know, going on, you know, Vimeo, Video Static, seeing what's new on all the blogs, like kind of keeping abreast of not only like what the older, more established talent is, but also what kind of the new cats that are out there. So we kind of take all that information and present it, and we do kind of, once we have that song and that budget, we do huddle up with the artists and try and have a conversation up front about what they want to accomplish with it, and then we kind of go out and call from the many lists. And then on the other side of that, there's reps that are hitting us up all the time with new work from the directors, and that goes into the pile as well. So it's really just, you know, I don't want to say I physically have a list, but I do probably have about 100 stickies on my desktop with lists of
these. You're one of the last, one of the last group of users of the stickies program. I like that. I'm also a stickies user.
I wish I could show you my desktop here. Whenever I give my computer to someone, they like are in complete shock. I try to keep my icons down, but my stickies are out of control. So,
and you mentioned you know, because a lot of directors aren't out there kind of just floating on their own. They are represented by, you know, reps and production companies and stuff. So it seems like you have a relationship with kind of all parties, with the directors and the reps and everyone involved. You kind of try to keep all those channels open.
I do. I mean, obviously, there's a trust factor, and you know, there's a risk factor involved when you kind of reach out of that pool of production companies that have their support or reps that are giving their kind of name. But you know, it would I wouldn't put somebody that's just, you know, completely new to the game or not really, you know, involved with a production company or a rep or at least some kind of connection that I know up for the biggest job. But I definitely think you could find diamonds in the rough there. And I like to like reach out to a lot of those people and catch them early and just say I like their work. And if there's a smaller video that could serve as kind of like a get to know you or just kind of like an icebreaker, I definitely like to bring those people in. And sometimes that leads to them, you know, latching on with people. And sometimes we'll put those newer directors in contact with production companies we like to kind of help facilitate it and help us feel a little bit more at ease with the process, you know?
And the, you know, the relationship between, you know, an artist and director for the duration of a music video is, you know, in terms of, you know, compared to like a feature is so short. You know, what are you looking for in a director, maybe not on the artistic side, but in terms of you know, how they work? Is there a particular set of qualities that really make a great music video director, you know, today?
Yeah, I like collaborators. I like people that aren't too stuck in their own world. I think that, like, you know, it is like a truly artistic medium, but it's also very much like a commercial. And, you know, we're out to sell this song, we're out to sell this album. So I need to know that I'm going to have somebody that, you know, is going to want to collaborate with the artist and it's going to be fairly, you know, quiet when we get through the note process. I try not to overdo things and I try and make sure that there's as much on the table prior to shooting and everyone kind of knows going in what to expect, but it's an artistic process and things change and sometimes the final product doesn't end up like the treatment, let's say. So you want to leave room for that, but you know, that kind of goes both ways. So I don't know. I like collaborators and good communicators and people who can kind of communicate their vision to people. Because if you can't really do that, I kind of have doubts about whether you can actually make it happen. That obviously does happen, but I'm trying to minimize my risk a lot of the time, you know.
Now, so. Speaking of that risk, I mean, once the music video is made and the band has, or, you know, the label and, you know, has a reaction to it one way or the other, are you involved in either mitigating, you know, disappointment with that?
It happens. Yeah, I mean, it's on the smallest videos to the biggest videos, and it's not really about that in terms of budget. It's just, you know, sometimes the smaller things are harder because to navigate, because, you know, you've got newer building bands that are ultra aware of their, using this word, but their brand or their aesthetic. And, you know, if that's not going to be in line, you can't force them to do that. You can't force them to put something out. So we really try and, you know, in the end of the day, I like to make sure that the artist is happy and proud of the video. And everything else kind of tends to fall in line after that. If they're not, then we have to find a way to change it and to make them happy with it. So that's where that collaboration comes in. You know, it's like sometimes it's not going to end up. I think it's more, to me, the videos are more of the artist videos than the director videos. And I know all the directors are going to think that's probably not the best thing to hear, but people are coming to it for the music, and that's where I'm coming to it from. So I want to make sure that we're not, you know, just that people aren't losing the plot in that respect. Does that make sense, or does that seem completely self-involved on that?
No, that does. I mean, especially because you are, you know, representing the or you know, working so closely with artists and the label in that respect, and they're the clients in a way. I would suppose.
Yeah. And you know, in the end of the day, I mean, that's where I'm going to hang my hat is with the artists and making sure they're happy and building their career. And I mean, I come from production. I used to direct myself, so I know how hard that side is. And I tend to be, and a lot of us at Columbia are very, like, you know, conscious of what it takes to go into production, from writing a treatment and all the time spent on that all the way through, you know, delivering the video and being happy with it and wanting to put it on your reel. So you know, I want it to be a win-win, but in the end of the day, like, you know, it's the artist video, and it's going to live with them for a long time. It's going to define them and their career as well. So
now, you mentioned, you know, you have worked as a director before, and you've won and been nominated for MVPAs. And, you know, you have a track record of being a director for music videos. Is that something that is common among video commissioners to be former directors, or is that relatively rare?
I don't know any others that are. I've heard of them going the other way. I think that there's something about being on set every day as a commissioner and learning the process that it might become somewhat, you know, it might seem like an attainable thing to do. Like, oh, I can direct. And I think that in the reverse way, some commissioners have turned to directing and have gotten good at it. But I don't know a lot that have come the other way. And when I first took the job, I was pretty hesitant about it, to be honest with you, because I didn't want to kind of quote unquote like leave behind my director career. But it came at a time for me personally that I thought it was a good move. And I also kind of saw the value, you know, as a director, I could say the thing that I was frustrated with was the communication with the artists and not being able to kind of just tell them my idea, you know, and like if they would just get it. And I felt like there was always this wall, and maybe now on that wall, I guess. But, you know, the reason why I got into music videos, or anybody gets into music videos, is because they love music. And I just wanted to kind of be more of a part of that and work with directors that I was inspired by and that I can never do. So I think that's what drives me from that end. But I don't know. It's a rare thing, but I love it now. I don't feel like, you know, like, oh, I wish I was directing instead of commissioning. I've actually taken to it in a way that I never thought I would. And it's because of the relationship that I get to have with the artists that maybe aren't there. I mean, you might write a treatment, shoot the video, edit the whole video, and the only time you've ever talked to the artist is like on the day of the shoot, you know? And then even if it's an incredible video, like that's just kind of the way that the business is. And that wasn't fulfilling enough for me. I wanted to kind of feel like I was part of the band or something, if that makes sense, you know? And I think now I get to do that. I get to talk to them about it on a larger level and even bigger than just this one video. But how's this going to relate to that and moving forward? And I'm a big music fan. I mean, I went to film school. I love films. But I think that the reason I got into music videos was more just to be a part of music and to become the best music video director and maybe, you know, and maybe have that lead to something else. I mean, I didn't go to school to be a music video director. You know, I don't think a lot of people do. I think it's something that they find that they're good at, or maybe they didn't make a film, or they don't have that part in them, or maybe they're just not ready to get into commercials or something. But it's something that, like, you know, filmmakers fall into rather than kind of set out with the target of being a music video director. You know, I don't want to say it's a fallback, but it's something that's kind of a part of their early formative career, you know.
And you mentioned leaving music video directing behind. Is that something that you're obligated to do as a video commissioner, or is it just you've moved on to a new career and you won't go back?
You can't. I don't think I'm obligated to not direct, but it's just I've got, you know, literally 12 to 15 things going on at once. And when I direct, I know directors are like this, like I was very micro-focused, and there's no way I could sit in an editing room with an editor or, you know, do pre-pro on a video with my schedule as it is now. I don't feel like I would be doing it justice. And that's why I just couldn't continue doing it. You know, I kind of had those dreams and fantasies when I first started the job that I would continue that, but it just worked out where I couldn't. And it's more of a time management thing than kind of like a rule of thumb or whatnot.
Now, I was wondering if you could, as an example, take us through you know, an example video of, you know, what the process was like on the commissioner level. And the one we were wondering about is the video that you appear in as a cameo, the Foster the People Houdini video. And we know that video was, you know, shot and, you know, finished long before its release. But I was wondering if you could give us some insight on the process of choosing the Daniels, or Daniels, sorry, not the Daniels, for that video and why that worked out.
Well, I'm a big fan of the Daniels, or Daniels, let's say. and part of that is going back to what I said before. Like, I like working with directors that I don't think I could do that when I was directing. And they definitely fall under that category. And they fall under kind of this new school, new breed of director, which, you know, when I was going to film school in the late 90s, aging myself now, there was nobody with those type of skills that could do everything, could do their effects, could work with actors, you know, had a sense of pacing and editing and all that. And that's kind of indicative of this new breed. And when they did a video for us for Manchester Orchestra for Simple Math, which was incredible. And we were all just kind of like, that was one of those treatments that came in that, you know, Brian, my cohort, commissioned that one, but it was one of those like true faith missions where you see a treatment, you know the directors are great, you don't know how they're going to pull it off, but you just go for it because it's a risk worth taking. And even on set, you know, I remember him telling me, I have no idea what this is going to be like. You like they shoot shots that are like 4 seconds long and then move on. So they had everything in their head, and it turned out incredible. We were all just so thrilled with it. And that kind of started our fascination with them. And you know, we've kind of taken the Daniels under, you know, if we could, we would sign them to an outright contract to Columbia Records to do every music video. And they almost have done every music video for us for the last almost year and a half now. But for Houdini, just because that was your question, but, you know, the Foster the People was kind of a new band that we all knew that was great, and also that there was a lot of support behind it. And by that, I mean, you know, we had money for the videos that you don't usually have for new artists. And they were really into doing stuff. Like sometimes with a new band, they want to be shrouded in mystery, but these guys like really wanted to be involved and were willing to put themselves physically, emotionally. Like Mark Foster, the lead singer, like is an actor. Like they all kind of wanted to be involved in it, which is great, because I kind of like got a sense of like, you know, the Weezer videos or Beastie Boys videos or those videos where the artist is such a part of the video and is making fun of themselves and is having fun and just feels like, you know, wants to take you along for this ride. So naturally we were like, well, the Daniels are perfect, you know, collaborator for this type of thing. And they wrote some incredible treatments. They wrote an incredible treatment for Helena Beat, we didn't end up doing, and they wrote an incredible treatment for Houdini, which we did end up doing. And I think this was, like you said, probably shot over a year before the video was actually released. And you know, it was one of those things where as soon as we got the treatment and everyone was like, wow, like this is incredible. The band is all about kind of dark, you know, similar to their music, they're about fun visuals, outlandish visuals, but kind of like a dark, you know, center to it, kind of like how, let's say, Pumped Up Kicks is, lyrically versus the music. And the tone of that video really set in them that it was going to, you know, it was really going to exemplify the song. So, you know, I was like, you know, kind of prepped on the way Daniels work on set. We did a lot. We were able to kind of do a lot of pre-production with the band, which is also very rare. We have like a behind-the-scenes video out, which people can see, but that, you know, we did dance rehearsal, and we spent all this time prior that now would be impossible to get with the band because they're so busy and all over the world. But at that time, they were willing to give us a few days, and we were all in Los Angeles, and we got together for meals and for pre-production and just went over everything. So it was really one of those kind of like music video film school type environments where the band was learning a lot. They had not really made any videos on this level before, and Daniels were very, very excited about kind of just us, the trust factor that they had earned from the label on Manchester and us giving them that space to kind of create their vision. And past that, I mean, all the pieces kind of came together for that. I could speak specifically into how I ended up in the video, which was not originally intended, but I don't know. Is there anything else on the process that you guys want some clarification on? Or
no, I think go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just going to say that's really good, but yeah, we definitely want to hear how you ended up being in it also.
Okay. So it was kind of funny. The band has two managers, Brent and Brett. And originally, we show up on the first day of shooting. We're really kind of shooting linearly. Is that the right word? Linearly.
I think that's close. I think, yeah, I don't know it either.
And they're like, hey, is Brett here? He said he was going to be in the video. And just to back up a little bit, Daniels are kind of obsessed with, like, meta casting. They want everything to be very, like, real, and there to be some inside joke involved in it. Like, if you could bring your family down and they put them in the video, or, like, your long-lost cousin or somebody who, you know, waited the table for you that morning, they want to have all those connections kind of involved to heighten the experience for everybody. And, you know, they had this role in there, which was the band manager, and one of the real managers they had wanted to play. And we get to set, and they're like, okay, we got to do this shot. Is Brett here? And I'm like, no, he's not here. Let me call him. He's like, because we got to get started shooting. So I give Brett a call, and I'm like, hey, the guy said you're supposed to be in the video, and they're about to shoot. Are you almost here? And he's like, I never said that. I never... the video. I told them I didn't want to be in the video. And I'm like, okay. So I called the other manager. I was like, do you want to do it? But you got to get here soon because they want to shoot. And he's like, no way. He was just more like stone faced. Like, I don't show up in videos. Okay. So I go back to Dan. I'm like, look, they said there was a miscommunication here. They're not going to do it. And literally, they kind of scanned everyone that's standing around. And they come back to me and they're like, do you want to do it? And I'm like, nah, I got to kind of do my thing as the commissioner on set. And they're like, look, it's one thing. Like, you just got to go. We'll put you in this sweater and you just have to do this look. And I was kind of like, okay, assuming, honestly, that it was one shot, that I was going to go in, do a reaction or whatever, and that was going to be the end of it. It turned out we did it. Everybody, including the band, like, was so like, oh, wow. And I guess I got caught up in all that. And then they were like, okay, by the way, like, you know, this is a role that, you know, it was a 2-day shoot that we're going to have to go back to. So I was like, okay. And originally I would have been like, no, thinking it was just one shot, but I think everybody kind of tricked me into it. And like, you're co-starring with the band in this video. And up the whole thing that it's all about it and getting meta on it and digging into my character. And I loved it because I think the video, I mean, it's hard for me to kind of separate, like, this is one of the best videos I've ever worked on. And I showed it to people and they're like, of course it is, you're in it. But even if I was, I trust that it is a great video and it just rides that line so well. And it was such a shame for us to have to sit on it for so long because I thought it would have been so impactful early on in the campaign for that band. But and it was almost to the point where Daniels would like email me every other week, like, please don't tell us this video is getting canned. And I was like, are you kidding? This is like the greatest thing ever. Of course we're putting it out. And they stopped emailing me after like 6 months. And I think it was eventually like 10 months after we finished that we actually released it. And I am glad that they chose me for the role and that the managers were not down to be in it. And, you know, there's also a ton of other cameos in there. Candace, who's the executive producer at their production company's in it. Gaetano, who was the producer for them at the time, he was in it as the producer. They actually had two other directors, Dori Oskowitz and Hiro Murai, played themselves. Larkin the DP is in it. So there is a lot of that stuff going on. Like I said, the Daniels love that kind of meta casting stuff. But I still, it's funny, like, you know, we have videos playing in the lobby of our office here at Sony Music, and that is one of the videos playing. And I hate, like, walking through the lobby and seeing, like, myself cry. But it comes to work, it's just hate. Why is this video up here? I have to look at this guy every day. So I think they put like a rule forth after that video that commissioners can no longer be in the videos anymore, which I thought was pretty funny. So,
well, you had it was an emotional role. It was more than just a look. It was definitely an integral part of the video. I don't know if the managers could have pulled it off. They probably lucked out to have you in there.
I don't think they could either. I think it's, you know, the great about that video is that, you know, the label will go to any stretch possible to keep the show alive, and the band just loved that aspect of it, even though it was so dark, and maybe set it up in a tongue-in-cheek way to be such like kind of a cut out kind of, I don't know, with like a boy band type of thing. So I think they were not as self-conscious, let's say, as some bands were, and I thank them for that because I think it was a fun video as a result. So
now I also wanted to ask you about discovering new directors, because I know that is part of, you know, your job. You mentioned going on different sites looking for new material. And I was wondering if there was a director or two in particular that, you know, lately that you have kind of brought into the music video industry that you're particularly, you know, interested in and interested in their work.
I think that I don't want to take credit for anyone, like bringing anyone in. I mean, a lot of the times you know, it's something that might be a slow burn. Like, I remember meeting with A.G. Rojas like a year, 2 years ago after he had done, I forget the video, but a video a while ago, and one of the reps brought him by. I was like, this guy's new, he's great, and I just wanted to meet him. I really am a fan of like meeting people and getting to know them and knowing that we have a good communication going on, and you know, he had written a few fantastic treatments for me and never really didn't get any of them, and then finally he wrote an incredible treatment for Jack White for 16 Saltines that we did, and that turned out fantastic. It actually was just nominated for a VMA as well, and I think that's one of those situations where, you know, he had written a treatment that was great, and I had really, because of kind of following his path from meeting with him early on and then seeing the other videos he was doing and feeling really comfortable with his growth and that he could deliver on what was a pretty, like, you know, a pretty big opportunity to work with Jack, who has such like kind of a canon of music videos and also like to deal with the pressure of doing that. I felt so comfortable with him because I had known him, I'd kept up with him, he'd written other treatments, none of which we did, but it had all kind of led to that point and doing that video. And I liked that. I liked kind of following that path. So I, you know, it's getting to know a director early on, and maybe if we're not doing a video at that moment, it's always like sowing seeds or whatnot, you know, and something that might pay off in the future. I remember going back to when I was directing, I would love to go in and meet with people because I thought that would expand, you know, on them knowing who I was and feeling, you know, trusting me a bit more after, you know, talking to me face to face. So that was a great kind of like, you know, front to back experience with them. I mean, I have a lot of directors that, you know, I try and get in the mix. You know, I let write on stuff all the time. Sometimes if they don't have the reels or they don't have the videos to kind of support their treatments, it's a little bit hard to convince people that they can pull it off. Even if I have supreme faith in them, it's like I gotta have the artist having supreme faith. I gotta have a manager having supreme faith. I gotta have the label. So, you know, there's a lot of convincing to be done. Even though they trust us and they know that we do this every day, it's still, people kind of want to feel that that safety net of somebody who's gone through the war before and made a video or whatnot. So, or multiple times. So, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of directors that I work with multiple times, you know, Dori Oskowitz, Hiro Murai, Daniels, you know, all those guys are guys that I know will always deliver. So I tend to work. I mean, it's kind of a funny story going back when coming from the directing side, and when I first came to the label, I noticed that my cohort, Brian, who brought me in, was working with a lot of the same people over and over again. And I was so confused by that because I was like, wow, we're not giving anybody like opportunities. You know, I kind of looked at it from my director perspective, which was, if I'm not in, how do I get in? How do I get past that kind of like that little crew that they have that they always work with? And I was like, I'm going to change this. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to work with new people all the time. And that was good. And I still do that. And I probably got burned a few times doing that as well on videos that maybe didn't turn out as good as I had hoped. And I came to realize that, you know, you want to have that kind of connection to them. You want to know that they can deliver. You want to know that they're at a company that will support the project from the beginning through the end. And so I've kind of come a little bit more balanced on that, because you can't just purely be a gunslinger and get new people for videos all the time. And it's just, you know, it's a process. And I think, you know, directors have to realize everything they do, even a treatment that they write for us, if they don't get it, is a big thing. You know, we read them, we look at them. You might have a great idea that we love that just the artist isn't feeling for whatever reason, and sometimes against their own best interest. But we know that the director is talented and we see their ideas. And so that stuff is like, you know, it goes a far way for us.
And prior to a director being established, and, you know, you mentioned kind of, you know, seeing them early on, like how are you able to keep up with a director before they kind of make that break? Because it's not like a band where you can kind of follow their live shows in small bars until they make it big. I mean, do you just kind of hang on to treatments that you liked, even though it was someone who wasn't established yet, or are there other means you're able to keep up with these guys?
Stickies. Yeah, I've got lists and I've got stuff like that. I mean, I got to say, if there's any directors out there that are listening to this, put your contact info somewhere. Put it on your Twitter page, put it on your Facebook somewhere, because sometimes I can't even find out how to connect to directors that have stuff out. Like, they have a Vimeo page, there's no information there. You know, sometimes I have to send like a direct message. Like, I'll go and I'll dig deep. I'll try and find people, but make it easy for people to find you, because there are people that, you know, are digging like this all the time. And maybe it's just to say, hey, this is a great video. Like, let us know, like, please send me any new work you have. You know, it could be as simple as that. Or here, do you want to take a stab at writing this treatment? So I keep a good kind of a list of things that I like. And, you know, it's not separated that much into like genre or whatnot, but I always go through it. Every time I go through the same stuff, when I have a new song and I have an opportunity to bring in newer talent, either with, you know, newer bands or with lower budgets or whatnot, I always kind of comb through that and see what might work. Because, you know, it's just you might find the diamond in the rough. So,
and before we let you go, I have one question that's sort of outside the realm of music videos, but I ran across this on your bio and just had to ask this to get more information, because you mentioned that you were part of the early 2000s startup video.com, and which I think or started maybe even earlier than that, but was done around, you know, early 2000 2002. And I actually have heard of this I can't remember how, but when I read it in your bio, the name sparked my imagination. But I was just wondering, do you think that it, I mean, YouTube kind of came in at the right time for technology? I mean, what was the reason that you guys kind of called it quits?
I think the biggest thing was just different people moving in like a different directions, like not enough of moving down the stream in the same direction. It's part of the reason why I also kind of stopped directing with my directing partner, David Chaffee. And I think it got to a point where things like a YouTube were doing it way better than we ever could. And we want it to be a closed community. We want it to be something that had a filter. We didn't understand the concept of just letting anybody post something up. We wanted to kind of curate it, let's say, to our tastes and to our viewers' tastes. And I think we just got swallowed. I think things are coming back in that direction a lot. But at that time, that was not the way of the future. You know, the way of that time, and how a Vimeo or a YouTube, or even the networks that were coming out, you know, at that time, like, they had money behind them and we didn't. But, you know, it was more of an all-inclusive type of atmosphere. And I think it was just, you know, the natural kind of things, like, kind of falling apart. I mean, sometimes I kind of think back, I actually am more regretful of that falling apart than my directing career falling apart. I'll tell you that much. But,
well, it must have been really difficult to operate a kind of a startup in that time when video on the internet was very difficult. I mean, not everybody had broadband. The whole infrastructure was a lot different than it is now.
It was horrible. It was like dial-up access and making like 8 different streams of videos for, you know, whatever user could come on. Like, you would have to have like, what, like 4 links to, like, do you have DSL 33 or...
Saul's got a job that I feel like I would love to have. Seems like he gets to do really cool things. He makes decisions on really cool things. So that's it.
I don't know if I'd trust myself with that. It's tough, you know.
Oh, I would be horrible at the job, but it's it would be great. It would be great. You ever seen that picture of Spider-Man at a desk, and it says, "I have no idea what I'm doing," or something like that? Or
I saw one today where a dog was playing mini golf, and I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Yeah,
I have no idea what I'm doing. That would be me at his job, but it would be so fun. It would be like the most fun 4 days and $10 million I've ever lost, because because it would be a Blasty McNasty.
Did you just say Blasty McNasty?
I did. You know why? Because you know what else is Blasty McNasty? Picks of the week.
My microphone just fell down. That's right. Picks of the week.
Or Blasties. I know you've got a gem, so why don't you go first?
Okay, go ahead. And I know that you picked before the podcast started because you want to go first.
No, wait, I said you go first, but
wait,
I
you said me go first? Oh man, okay, I'll go first.
Go.
Okay, this is one that just came out today, September 4th, and it came out in the morning, and I really enjoyed it. It is for a band that I've never heard of in my life before, called Necroglobicon, called No One Survives. And this is interesting because, you know, I have friends that are really into really hard metal. I don't know anything about that genre, so I don't know whether to call it hard, you know, heavy metal or thrash metal, or death metal. I don't know. I just know these buzzwords and things like that. I just don't know anything about the genre, but I know that it is a very hard, fast song. And I get a lot of notifications in my inbox for posts about music videos from websites like the Metal Underground and a few other ones that are, you know, there's big fan communities around these metal bands. And you know, I always look at the videos and you know, they seem to be along a similar vein a lot. Of course, we put them up on the site, their music videos, and we definitely want to represent the metal genre in that. But this one definitely caught my eye. It is a story about a goblin that is, you know, it's kind of a classic story about this guy who's at work and he likes a girl and kind of feels overlooked and, you know, kind of an unrequited love thing. But the person in this video in question is a goblin, and actually some pretty convincing goblin makeup. And another thing that makes this video pretty awesome are the people who are in it. The woman who plays the love interest is none other than Miss Caden Cross, and you may know her from porn. She's a porn actress of some repute. And also we have Mr. John Lajoie, who is famous for his what is the song he does?
He does a lot. Everyday Normal Guy.
Everyday Normal, that's the one I was thinking of. We saw him in Miami, he was great. He does a cameo as a bartender. He knows the director, apparently, Brandon Dermer. But it's just a really kind of funny, well done video, and you know, I think it marks a good point for metal videos. I'm really glad to see a metal video or metal band and a director coming up with a really fun, interesting video for a metal song, and you know, putting some really interesting cameos in there, making it humorous, making it interesting to watch. And I think that's great. So I really enjoy the video. That's Necroglobicon. And the song is called No One Survives.
You know Brian Posehn is?
I do know who Brian Posehn is.
He's got a metal band. He's got a song called Metal by Numbers. And it's just like all about how metal is kind of by, like, paint by numbers. And I know very little about metal. The extent of my metal history is probably like Tenacious D. But the Brian Posehn song, really fun. So I just said that. It's got a music video, so you should watch it. It's not my pick of the week.
In the shout outs.
Yeah, we allow shout outs, right. That's what that was all about. Mm-hmm. But it's not my pick of the week. My pick of the week is something different. So
I didn't take your pick of the week, did I?
No, you didn't. I'm gonna get into it. No, definitely you didn't pick my pick of the week. However, my pick of the week is something that if you listen to this podcast, you've almost have to have seen. My pick of the week is by A Man in Two Chains, and the song is Birthday Song.
Man, these picks of the week are so good this week.
Some good picks of the week. It features a guy named Kanye West, this song does, and the video. It's directed by Andres Nilsson, and who was a director of a pick of the week by Hiro Murai in a previous episode, one of the rare guest picks of the week that we featured on this show, back when he directed a Mike Snow music video. And this Birthday Song music video by 2 Chainz. 2 Chainz is a, I guess I would call it like a pop style rapper, you know, very popular style, radio friendly, not in content, but in kind of just how it sounds. It's friendly for the radio, you know, big heavy beats and that kind of thing. Anyway, the video, however, is not your standard hip-hop video at all. It's got elements of your standard hip-hop video, but also very subtle elements of beauty and hilariousness and absurdity, and old men. There's a lot of old men, and if you pay attention, there's a lot of old men. Some in birthday hats, some dancing. You know, I'm not going to try to capture this video in an explanation any more than I already have. I'm not going to kind of give you a blow by blow because it's too good to just.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and just to see how it's executed is what it's all about. Because if I just described it, it would be like, oh, that's weird, but I don't get it. But you have to just see how it kind of all fits together and the kind of strange landscape that's created in this video, because it's definitely like a very like a surreal, unusual world, especially for a rap video. And I really kind of thank them for putting it out. And so that's why it's my pick of the week. 2 Chainz featuring Kanye West, Birthday Song.
Now, I think that you hit a nail on the head there, where it creates a surreal world, and it creates a world unto itself. I think that's something that hip-hop video is just, it's an opportunity that they miss so much. And I really think if you're going to watch this video, watch it all the way to the end. Some of the best stuff is in the last scene.
It really all kind of, it's a hodgepodge. Everything you saw up until that point. Like, that's a sure, like, that phrase you just used, watch it to the end. That's like a surefire thing of, like, a video not being good, that you have to tell someone to do that. But, like, maybe you think, like, this video will lose steam after seeing it at the beginning or something. It's like, all right, I get it. It's this weird world and those weird things. No. Push on if you start to lose interest, which I think would be strange if you did. You're a strange guy, man, who's lost interest in this video. 5 minutes and you can't. What's wrong with you, guy?
And the casting is just especially good for this. They just know where to put people, and it's not just the girls. It's like the Pakistani guy with the 40 dancing. It's the clown. They just who are, you know, the casting for this was just
the spot on. The family sitting at the table. It's a juxtaposition of, you know, elements that you're used to in hip hop videos too, like, you know, objectification of women, but like cranked up to a really self aware kind of over the top level, and then placed, you know, in these really strange scenarios. Like there's like a family sitting around the table with like children and grandparents and stuff, and they're sitting around a cake that's made out of a live naked woman. I mean, it's just hilarious stuff. So check it out.
There we go. I think that's this is a fantastic episode. Number one A+ episode. Would listen again, and I thank you for listening. My name is Adam Fairholm. With me, as court mandated, Douglas Klinger by contract. You can find us on Twitter at @FilmedInsert, and you can also I highly recommend following this new account that we have. It's just at @NewMusicVideo. It's on Twitter and on Facebook, and when a new music video is added to the site within 3 days of the day, so let's say it's September 4th, any music video that we add that premiered from the 4th to the 1st gets tweeted there and with a link, so you can kind of stay up to date on what music videos are new. And it gets tweeted and it gets also posted to Facebook. So check that out. Definitely follow that account as well as the main one. I will retweet some ones and mention videos when we really like something. But you get the whole feed. You get that.
You get the whole piece of the pie.
Yeah, the whole piece.
The whole pie, even.
The whole pie, yeah.
Oh, man.
We'll see you next time.
The disdain in your voice.